This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, December 4th, 2013. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, driving while intoxicated. We talk to local officials about an increase in DWI violations. Also, we attend a tasting at 28 Springs in Siloam Springs.
Plus, Fayetteville High School students prepare for the 15th annual homeless vigil, which could face postponement due to inclement weather. We will also have a list of events that have been postponed or canceled due to the approaching winter storm and more.
But first, state finance officials say Arkansas revenue in November came in below expectations this year and did not meet last year's figures. The state's net available general revenue last month totaled $349.7 million. That's just under $1 million less than the same time last year and $8.4 million below forecast. John Shelnut is an economist with the Arkansas Department of Finance and Administration. He says November numbers were affected by swings in corporate income taxes.
I don't think this is a good indicator month for any trends. You know, for sales tax, I'm not sure at this point whether we are looking at a weak holiday sales pattern or not. Sales related to the shopping season and Thanksgiving will be recorded in December collections.
He says overall state revenue for this fiscal year is way above forecast, which should help with the lackluster numbers from last month.
We have benefited across the year in terms of high sales in automobiles, and that could turn also. But at this point, we're above forecast by $29 million, so we have a bit of a cushion.
According to the department, the November numbers were affected by swings in corporate income taxes. Gross collections in corporate tax income were $4.2 million below forecast and 41.6% below last year's levels.
The Fayetteville City Council last night approved new height and setback regulations for certain areas in the city. The ordinance, which has been under consideration for the past few months, was passed after being amended to only offer protections to single-family homes adjoining development sites in downtown General and Main Street zoning areas, which are specifically found in the downtown and Walker Park neighborhoods. The amended proposal would only apply to single-family homes being used as single-family residences and wouldn't exclude houses converted to office or for commercial use. The new rules require that new construction, such as commercial, office, parking decks, or mixed-use developments, taller than 24 feet, have a minimum setback of 15 feet from the side or rear of adjacent property. Developments could only go as high as 36 feet before an additional 15-foot setback would be required. Alderwoman Sarah Marsh, who originally proposed the changes to height and setback regulations, says the new form of the ordinance closely resembled its drastic original form.
We had the 15-foot setback in it, and the intention of that was to do something really extreme so that when we came back with something later that everyone would say, oh, that's so much better. Now here we are back at this really extreme language. You know, and my intention with the previous ordinance, you know, with all the amendments, was to find something that was really strategic and context sensitive and not something that was this broad and sweeping. I can't support this, even though there's a lot of good intention in here.
She calls the ordinance a gross distortion of what she had initially intended. Marsh and Alderman Matthew Petty were the only two who voted against the ordinance.
The Fort Smith Board of Directors last night passed an operating budget for the next fiscal year. According to the City Wire, the budget as passed includes expenditures of $47.9 million, while revenue are expected to be $45.7 million. The $2.2 million deficit will be accounted for by carrying over the ending balance for the current fiscal year.
Arkansas home sales continued to grow through the month of October. According to the Arkansas Realtors Association, 2,214 homes were sold during the month, representing a 13.8% increase over October 2012. During the month, Pulaski, Benton, and Washington counties were the top three ranked markets in terms of homes sold, and sales in the top five markets represented 53.2% of the statewide totals, an increase of about 3% over last year. For the year, Benton County has the highest home sales total, with 3,926 units sold, representing a nearly 23% increase over last year. and Washington County, which was ranked third with 2,200 units sold for the year, a year-over-year increase of about 20%.
A University of Arkansas study regarding the impact of school field trips to museums has gone viral. According to the university, researchers Brian Casita, Jay Green, and Dan Bowen, who published a study showing the impacts of field trips to Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, wrote a column on the topic late last month for the New York Times Sunday Review section. The piece, published on November 24th, was the second most emailed piece 7 days after its publication, and it drew more than 32,000 shares on Facebook.
Forecast this evening calls for mostly cloudy skies with overnight lows from 29 in northwest Arkansas to 36 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, Thursday, occasional freezing rain and sleet through the day, with temperatures falling to around 27 degrees by late afternoon. Ice accumulations between 1 3/10 inches are possible. Tomorrow evening, occasional sleet and freezing rain with overnight lows around 19. Wind chills could reach as low as 10 degrees in northwest Arkansas, and lows of 25 in the Arkansas River Valley.
This is Ozarks at Large. For more than three decades, the Little Rock, North Little Rock, and Pulaski County school districts have been embroiled in litigation regarding the desegregation of those school districts. For years, the state of Arkansas has been paying tens of millions of dollars to the three districts under the guise of federal court supervision. In late November, all parties in the long-running lawsuit agreed to a settlement that will end the now $65 million a year payments from the state to the districts in 4 years. Erica G., Chief of Staff for Attorney General Dustin McDaniel, was recently a guest on KARK's Capitol View. The political television program can be seen Sunday mornings at 8:30 in the Central Arkansas Market and is hosted by Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas and David Goins. During a recent interview on the program, Erica G. shared what led to this historic legal settlement.
From the negotiation standpoint, Erica, how did this whole thing get started? Was this a situation where, you know, the state reached out to either the school district or one of the parties, or who kind of picked up the phone first, if that in fact was the case?
Well, as I think most people know, Attorney General McDaniel had been trying since 2007 to reach some kind of resolution in this case after the legislature passed the act asking him to do so. But the most recent efforts were really started by Dr. Suggs in Little Rock School District. I mean, he came into his position and came in to meet the general and immediately asked his attorney to set up a meeting so we could sit down and start talking about it. And that's what initiated it this time.
How do you feel when you've heard what Judge Marshall said on Friday at the DSEG hearing, the preliminary hearing? He said, you know, this is not in any way final, but he did say, I underscore that this is not a final approval from the court, but I see nothing that causes me concern. You got to feel pretty positive when a judge says that.
Oh, absolutely. I think all the parties came out of the hearing on Friday feeling that we had negotiated a good settlement that the judge is ultimately going to approve, final approval to.
Sure. I mean, what was maybe during this negotiation process maybe the trickiest part to kind of get through? Was there a point where, you know, since you're kind of so instrumental in this back and forth talking to the parties, we were thinking, I don't know, this might not happen? Or was there a point like that?
There were many points like that, to be honest with you. This case is so complicated. It's been going on so long, and there's all these different parties. Everybody's got their own point of view and their own concerns, and it was very difficult to negotiate through all of those and keep everybody heading in the same direction. And there was definitely more than one occasion where we were worried that we wouldn't be able to.
Do you think that the three school districts are desegregated, or you just think we're this close to a judge saying that they're desegregated? Does that question make sense?
It does make sense. Little Rock and North Little Rock are both unitary. They are officially desegregated. Pulaski County Special School District is not yet, but it's close. And that's part of what the agreement addresses, is some figuring out exactly what the remaining issues are to getting PCSSD unitary and how that should be done.
What do you think it means, though, to say that they are unitary, that they are desegregated? Technically, what does that mean?
It means that they no longer need to be under court supervision in order to monitor how race issues of race are handled in the school district, I guess would be the broadest way to answer that.
Obviously, from the major stakeholders in this case, there seems to be this unified front of satisfaction that there is the settlement in place. Do you know of anyone or any particular group that is not satisfied with what the outcome has been so far?
I don't. I think everyone involved in this case has tried very hard to satisfy the concerns that their constituents had during the process, to make sure that when we got to this point, everything had been addressed and everything had been resolved to the extent it's possible to do so.
That was Erica G., Chief of Staff for Attorney General Dustin McDaniel, speaking to Talk Business Arkansas's Roby Brock, along with his co-host, David Goins, on Capitol View. The political television program can be seen at 8:30 Sunday mornings on KARK in the Central Arkansas market. Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing diverse professional experience to clients across the United States. Mitchell Williams Law Firm employs nearly 80 attorneys at offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com.
And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at BankOzarks.com. And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. Coal, oil, natural gas, hydropower, and renewables. More at AECC.com.
This week in This American Life.
If you can't get 7 cars in 12 days, you got to look yourself in the mirror and say, holy, what are you kidding me?
A car dealership in Long Island tries to sell its monthly quota of cars, 129 cars. It's not going well.
I want balloons in the showroom. I just don't want one balloon to a car. Balloon the whole freaking place so it looks like a circus.
Will it work? Find out this week.
Thanksgiving was last week, and for some, it marks the official start of the holiday season. For one group in particular, it is definitely the beginning of a very busy season. Officers with the Fayetteville Police Department are on high alert Thanksgiving through Super Bowl Sunday, patrolling for those that might be driving under the influence of too much alcohol. Family gatherings and holiday parties are a time that many partake in festive spirits, only to get in their vehicles when the party is over and make their way home. Corporal Curtis Sutley is one of about 120 patrol officers with the city of Fayetteville. He says the department does have more officers on traffic duty during this two-month busy season and that they're on high alert for traffic violations.
As opposed to other areas of enforcement that other officers enjoy doing and try to focus on throughout the year, traffic enforcement becomes a higher priority for us during the holiday seasons.
An officer must have probable cause to pull someone over. They can't simply sit by a bar and pull a car over just because the driver walked out of an establishment that serves alcohol. During a typical week, Fayetteville sees about 20 driving while intoxicated arrests. But during a busy week, they can see up to 40. With 2,212 DWI arrests in 2012, compared to the almost 12,000 seen statewide, Fayetteville sees more DWI arrests than any city in the state. Fayetteville prosecuting attorney Casey Jones says it isn't just because it's a college town.
You have people come from other parts of the state and certainly other parts of the region because this is a popular place. We have a big entertainment industry. You have Dixon Street, you know, a lot of restaurants and the rest of it. So people come here and probably have a little too much to drink. And so we have, and on top of that, we do have a university, and that results, I think, in a higher number.
The cops aren't just patrolling campus or Dixon Street. Here's Corporal Sutley.
I patrol as many of the major thoroughfares as I can, but DWI is something that is not just a local problem. It's not a downtown problem. I've arrested DWIs on every street in this city, it seems like, but it's people traveling to, from, coming into, and going back out again.
Contrary to what some may believe, officers aren't just out there to get us. Driving while intoxicated is dangerous. Jones says that in 2010, the number of fatalities from automobile wrecks in the United States was the same as it was in the last year of the Eisenhower administration.
Now consider that. Our population was much less than it was in the last year of the Eisenhower administration. We drive a lot more miles per capita, and we have a lot more cars and a lot more roads that those cars travel on. Yet our deaths were the same as that. Why is that? Well, three things. One is cars are better made. The second thing is enforcement of seatbelt laws and the fact that we have seatbelts in vehicles, which they didn't have back then. But another thing is organizations like MAD forcing police departments and prosecutors to pay more attention to DWIs. And as a result of that, people are much more likely to get home because there's less drunk drivers out there.
It's also a change in culture. Watching a television show like Mad Men, which is set in the 1960s, you'll see the characters having cocktails in their offices at, say, 11 a.m. or 2 p.m. It's pretty much unheard of these days. Jones credits organizations like MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, to changing behaviors that were previously joked about.
One of the biggest changes I've seen in Fayetteville is the advent of cab companies. And I think that's who knows how many lives that has changed. Certainly has saved people thousands of dollars in fines and attorney's fees and the rest of it.
A quick Google search results in four cab companies with an address in Fayetteville. But say you choose to drive and you see those flashing blue lights behind the car. What can you expect?
You go through a series of questions with people. You identify yourself and explain why it is that you've stopped somebody. You start paying attention to everything around you, including where they're coming from, but how are they speaking? Are there any odors coming out of the vehicle, such as the odor of intoxicants or, in some cases, drugs? And you just go through a series of questions with them and make a determination then whether or not they need to come out of the car and go through a battery of field sobriety tests or if they're okay and send them down the road.
Those tests are the horizontal gaze nystagmus test, the walk and turn test, and the one-leg stand. Fail those, and you get a ride in the back of a police car straight to the police department inside the Washington County Jail. At that point, a breath test is given to test blood alcohol level. Anything over a percentage of 0.08 is legally intoxicated, 0.02 for those under the legal drinking age of 21. Sometimes it is heard that someone refused to blow, which is illegal and a charge in of itself. It's called violation of implied consent. By getting a driver's license, drivers are committing to taking that test.
But a lot of people think that by not taking the test, somehow they're going to get out of that DWI. I think Fayetteville probably has a higher rate of refusals, people refusing to take the test, than any other city in the state. I think that's because they come from their whatever town they're from, and their uncle, who's a lawyer, who says, oh, when you go up there, if you get a DWI, whatever you do, don't take the test. That might have been true 15 years ago, but it's not true now. There's been case law that says refusal to take the test is a sign that you're probably DWI.
In a DWI trial, that refusal can actually be used as evidence against someone, and the chances of being convicted are pretty good. In the last 5 years, Jones has seen driving while intoxicated charges increase in regards to those that are a result of drugs rather than alcohol.
The DWIs have changed from just being the guy that had a six-pack out at the lake and was driving home to perhaps somebody who borrowed his brother's ADHD medicine, had a couple of beers, smoked half a joint, and maybe took somebody else's Xanax, and in combination, one of those things by themselves might not be enough to affect their driving, but a combination of those things, we're seeing more and more of that. Where somebody might blow well below the legal limit of 0.08 when it comes to alcohol, they might blow a 0.04, 0.03, but they have other substances in their system which is affecting their ability to drive.
All ramifications are set by the state. The Omnibus DWI Act in Arkansas, which went into effect in 1983. It states that anything over the legal blood alcohol content level, 0.08, will result in a charge of driving while intoxicated. a first offense results in a minimum one day, but up to 365-day jail sentence. Usually the arrest serves as credit for that day served.
Your second one is a minimum of 10 days and a maximum of a year. The third is 90 to a year. But last year, there's been some changes in the law. Up until last year, if you had someone under the age of 16, you had a minimum of 10 days in jail. But with the help of David Whitaker, a state rep here, I wrote a law which if somebody is injured as a result of being involved in a DWI, in other words, you have a passenger and you had an accident and they somehow bloodied their nose, you're looking at a minimum of 30 days in jail and a maximum of a year. And if you're seriously injured, that now falls under the battery second and becomes a felony because we thought that DWIs where someone's actually hurt should be treated differently and be treated a little more seriously.
As Jones mentioned earlier, it isn't cheap, monetarily speaking. Court costs alone are $330. The average fine is $400, but it can be up to $1,000. Those guilty of a DWI will also spend money on alcohol classes that are required to get the license back. And car insurance goes up, more so if there was a refusal to blow. Many offenders plead guilty before ever stepping up against Jones and his team. But for the cases that do go to court, he relies heavily on the reports written by the Fayetteville police officers. When Corporal Sutley arrived at the prosecutor's office, he was friendly with the staff and appeared to know his way around. A good relationship with the prosecutor's office, he says, helps to more efficiently give them what they need. At the beginning of his 20 years as city prosecutor, Jones remembers an older cop telling him, "We'll catch him, you clean him." As a result, Jones has never had an officer question what is going on in his office. They understand that their jobs are important, and they understand the roles of government. To bypass the problem of a potential DWI, Jones says to either have a teetotaler for your date to holiday parties, or just have one drink.
The insidious thing about alcohol is not just your physical impairment, it impairs your judgment. And what happens is you know that you shouldn't drive on, but you have one drink and you know that. But the odd thing is 3, 4, 5 drinks and you start thinking, well, you know, I'm good to go. I'm not that impaired. And you might not seem to be that impaired. It's not driving while commode hugging drunk. It's driving while intoxicated, and intoxication is 0.08. And so the best bet, if you're going to drink at all, just don't drive.
Casey Jones is Fayetteville City Prosecutor, and Corporal Curtis Sutley is a member of the Fayetteville Police Department. This is Ozarks at Large.
Community and Family Institute, which is located in the University of Arkansas's Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice, often conducts a point-in-time census of the homeless in Northwest Arkansas. According to the 2013 census, it's estimated that on any given night, more than 2,400 people are without their own place in Benton and Washington counties. More than one half of those who are homeless in the region are 18 years old and younger. According to the census, the number of homeless youth attending school in the two largest counties in Northwest Arkansas has nearly tripled since 2007. One school district who has been bringing awareness to the issue of homelessness is the Fayetteville School District. Thursday evening, members of the Fayetteville High School Student Council will spend the night sleeping in makeshift housing on the high school's front lawn and using a fire in a barrel to stay warm as part of the annual homeless vigil. Senior Anders Bandy is FHS's student council president and one of about 24 students who will be sleeping outside on what looks to be a very cold Thursday evening. While members of student council are the ones sleeping outside, this event also serves as outreach to the community and their fellow students.
I had one person come up to me who was a student, and this was last year, and they saw what we were doing and they were like, wow, this is crazy because I didn't realize that it's weird to see my friends out in a box because it shows that, oh, you don't know the person next to you could be homeless. And it's kind of up or eye-opening for them because they can come out and see us living like that, and they're like, oh wow, if that was my best friend, I didn't even know it. It's just, it's kind of that experience for them.
Community members can support this initiative through monetary donations or contributions of non-perishable food items. Both will be used to help the district's Families in Transition program. According to the district's website, the Families in Transition program, with the assistance of the McKinney-Vento Homeless Assistance Act, helps children and families with things like enrollment, transportation, clothing, and school meals. During the 2012-2013 school year, the district worked with about 270 students who met the guidelines for homeless under the MV Act. There are 180 students already in the program this year. Since its inception, Student Council President Anders Bandy says the homeless vigil has raised more than $100,000. This year's goal has been set at $20,000, which is a little higher than in recent years.
In the past, we hadn't been getting as much, and so we lowered our goal. And I think that we lowered our goal, and so people were like, oh, okay, they have a lower goal, we don't need to donate as much. I think if we set the goal higher, the community will help us out. I feel like they'll meet our goal and match us up there. So I feel like this year it'll be a strong year. I feel like we'll get a lot of donations.
Mandy says it's fun to talk to people who stop by and ask questions. During her sophomore year, she says KNWA meteorologist Dan Scoff stopped by around midnight and rapped for the students. Speaking of meteorology, it looks like weather will play a significant role in this year's vigil. The National Weather Service has issued a winter storm warning for Northwest Arkansas, which will remain in effect from Thursday morning through Friday afternoon. Wintry precipitation is expected on Thursday, and depending on the severity, it could affect the homeless vigil.
We are going to be careful and safe, of course. If school gets canceled for that day, if we get sent home early from school, we're going to cut off the vigil. Or if like it starts to freeze while we're out there, more than just a little bit of snow. Because it has snowed the year before I came to Fayetteville High School, it snowed for the vigil. So we will stay out there if there's light snow and stuff. But if it's a big storm, then we'll skip it, send home. The school won't let us do it, which is kind of nice.
If weather does force a cancellation, Bandy says they will reschedule. However, that could be tricky with finals approaching, so the vigil may have to be moved to after Christmas. Bandy is preparing for the event by obtaining a camping sleeping bag, planning on wearing lots of layers, and continuing to look for boxes that can be used for shelter. She says Tyson Foods often donates boxes, and last year some students went dumpster diving for additional cardboard boxes. This will be Bandy's third time to participate in the homeless vigil, and she says her experience has taught her several things, like you can never have too many boxes.
If they're taped, all the cracks are taped. Gets a lot warmer because there's no wind that blows through on your face at 3 o'clock in the morning that wakes you up. So if you tape all your boxes, tape every crack, make sure there's a door kind of on your box to keep it closed. Also share like blankets with other people because like sleep close to other people. So we had our sophomore girl box 1 year and we all kind of cuddled in there and it was nice and warm.
Bandy says the event is a bit of a bonding experience for the student council because, for one thing, they want to best represent the homeless experience, so they try not to use their phones. Because of this, the students have lots of time to talk to and interact with one another. The vigil also serves as an educational experience.
Every year I learn more information about the homeless children in our district, and I've learned how crazy it is that to think about, oh, I'm going home every day, not even thinking about just going home to do my homework, whereas there's kids who don't have a home to go home to and they have to do their homework by the light in their car or something crazy like that. And it's just crazy to think about because I just take my house for granted. And then when you sleep outside in the cold, it's kind of like, wow, this is real. Like, people do this every day. So it's just kind of an enlightening experience.
Weather permitting, the Fayetteville High School Student Council will participate in the 15th annual homeless vigil on the front lawn of the school, beginning at 5 o'clock Thursday afternoon. Local residents can make a pledge to the vigil by emailing FHS Student Council sponsor Vance Arnold at vance.arnold@fayar.net. You can also make donations at the event. More information is available at fayar.net/FHS. This is Ozarks at Large.
KUAF is here for your community And in this season of giving, we hope you can help out as well. KUAF's Giving Tree will benefit the Outback program from Fayetteville Public Schools during the holidays. The Outback program is looking for non-perishable food items and gently used donations of children's clothing, shoes, and coats. Simply bring your donation to KUAF at 9 South School in Fayetteville and place it under our tree. Thanks and happy holidays.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas.
As we mentioned, the students hosting the homeless vigil at Fayetteville High School tomorrow night could potentially be impacted by the winter weather that's forecast to hit the area. That forecast has already caused a couple of events to be postponed or canceled. For example, the Drennan Scott Historic Site's second annual Victorian Christmas has been postponed until December 13th. The event, which was scheduled from 5:30 to 8:30 this Friday evening, will take place at the same time next Friday. The historic home will be decorated to appear as it did in 1899 for the holiday celebration and will feature Victorian-themed Christmas decorations, including a cornucopia containing real fruit. Eggnog and the Drennan Scott traditional sugared and salted pecans will be served at the event. Attendees can enjoy free carriage rides, and children will be able to make a Victorian ornament in an arts and crafts workshop. Live Christmas music will also be provided. Limited parking is available, but guests may park near the Crawford County Courthouse and walk to the site, which is a little more than a block away, or they can ride the free shuttle bus. There is no admission charge. For more information, you can call 262-2550, or you can email tom.wing@uafs.edu.
The second annual Heritage High School Community Leaf Removal Day Volunteer Project, where LINC leaders invite and work beside their respective freshmen, has been postponed from this weekend to December 14th. All other HHS school teams, clubs, and student groups are invited to participate. HHS students can provide vital services to neighbors facing challenges of yard maintenance and other simple homeowner tasks. The Community Leaf Removal Day will take place at homes surrounding the campus. The public is invited to participate, and event organizers have asked that volunteers bring a rake, gloves, water bottles, and a helpful attitude. Volunteer times are scheduled from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. For more information, call 479-631-3579, extension 225.
A patriotic concert in Bella Vista has been canceled due to this week's weather forecast. According to a press release issued by the Bella Vista Property Owners Association, the God Bless America concert planned for tomorrow at Reardon Hall has been canceled and it will not be rescheduled.
The 47th Silver Tee has been postponed until Friday, December 13th. Sponsored by the Women of St. James Episcopal Church, the tee is a benefit for Clear Spring School. Admission is by donation. More information by calling 479-253-5367.
The Northwest Arkansas Regional Network Orientation and Holiday Party, originally scheduled from 6 to 8:30 p.m. tomorrow at the Arkansas Alumni House on the University of Arkansas campus, has been canceled. The meeting will be rescheduled for January. Also, the Christmas parade and tree lighting in Pea Ridge that was scheduled for this Saturday has been postponed until next Saturday, December 14th. Cancellations and postponements will probably continue as this winter storm rolls into our area, so please check in with event organizers if you have questions about any events you are planning on attending in the next few days.
For a new era in medical coverage, we consider an integrative approach to health that cares for the whole person and includes gentle, natural techniques, not just high-tech medicine. And we learn how some aspects of integrative health will be supported by provisions of the Affordable Care Act. I'm David Freudberg. Join us for The Search for Well-Being, a special documentary from Humankind.
Listen Saturday at noon to 91.3 FM.
This past month has been a pretty good one for the culinary arts in Northwest Arkansas. Several restaurants in Bentonville collaborated to establish a relationship with the James Beard Foundation. The first part of that effort culminated with a trip to the foundation in New York City in November. And a Fayetteville restaurant, Greenhouse Grill, won a national competition last month and will have their recipe for a black bean slider served around the country as a result. But as Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums reports, there are interesting culinary events happening all over the region. He recently spent a night at 28 Springs in Siloam Springs during a special tasting at the restaurant, and here's that story.
The tasting at 28 Springs in downtown Siloam Springs in mid-November was based around butter. And if you saddled up to the sleek U-shaped bar at the restaurant for the 4-plus course meal, you had a few minutes of homework to do first.
2.5 minutes and you will have butter for your bread.
What do I have to do?
Shake.
Okay.
With enthusiasm.
Like that.
Yep, you got it.
All right.
Hey, Casey, grab one.
Every patron was handed a small jar and, after the prescribed 2.5 minutes of shaking, the contents inside the jar had formed into a rich helping of butter to be spread on the bread made inside the 28 Springs kitchen. Casey Letellier, who manages the bar and helps create the tasting menus, explains the shaking sparked a bit of culinary science.
Damage the little fat globules in the milk and the cream, and they come together and you make butter. It's simple, but this beautiful thing.
The tastings at 28 Springs pair beverage and appetizer, beverage and soup, beverage and entree, beverage and dessert. Casey Letellier works with the restaurant's head chef, Dorothy Hall, to dream up the matches. He admits the tasting menu, more often than not, has its origins with a drink, say bourbon, one of his favorites. But last month, the event was based around that cooking staple.
But the tasting we did tonight, we actually started more on her end, and we said, all right, let's show off butter. Let's show off all the amazing things you can do with butter. And then that actually makes my side super easy. All the things you can pair with butter are super easy to pair drinks-wise. So I wanted to do kind of a range of different possibilities. A wine and a cider and a beer and then finishing with a bourbon to just kind of show off all kinds of different directions you can go with pairings.
Each course comes out with a bit of a backstory. The grits in the catfish and grits appetizer are from War Eagle Mill. The bourbon paired with the dessert is from a small independent bourbon maker in Colorado. For Dorothy Hall, the head chef, the tastings are her own kind of homework.
Yeah, it's constant learning, and that's how I view this job. I will never know everything I need to know for this job. I love researching. I love reading cookbooks and trying new things. These tastings in particular are really beneficial for me because I'm always doing something new that I've never done before. And so I do the research, and then I cook it, and I learn.
Both Dorothy and Casey cite Miles James, the executive chef and guiding culinary figure for the restaurant, as an important influence. He's also the chef behind the menu at James at the Mill in Springdale. They both compliment his attitude of exploration and his emphasis on locally sourced food. Dorothy Hall says with all those moving parts and all those possible ingredients, the open kitchen at 28 Springs can, during dinner, look like a bit of controlled chaos.
Our kitchen is divided up into two zones. We have the front line and then we have the back line. During dinner service, especially on busier nights of the week, we have somebody at each different station. We have an appetizer station that's broken up into cold apps. We have hot apps. We have grill. We love our grill. It's a wood-fired grill. We get that locally. It's a mixture of hickory and oak, so you get that authentic smoky, woodsy flavor.
28 Springs has an in-house full-time pastry chef, and desserts, sauces, and more are all made inside the kitchen's walls.
During dinner service, this is where we rush around trying to replenish. During the daytime, we have a full-time saucier. His name is Robin, and he is wonderful. He does all of our sauces. Our list of sauces is over 30 of them. We start with our chicken stock, which is roasted chicken frames, caramelized vegetables. It's cooked for 48 hours. It's a beautiful base, and it turns into all of these other sauces. He also does all of our soups, and he is the king of the fish fry on Fridays.
With all of those possibilities at their disposal, Dorothy and Casey say they doubt they'll ever have to repeat a tasting idea. She says they speak the same culinary language, and that allows for the development of an overall theme for a particular tasting. But the duo doesn't feel bound by convention. The tasting inspired by butter last month included dashes of smoked paprika, cornbread stuffing, Scottish shortbread, and a butterscotch dessert that won universal approval. Casey says the tasting menus are a result of hard, but not undesirable, work.
We always do what we call a tasting of the tasting. Before we serve these, we sit down and we talk through the dishes, we talk through the pairings, and lots of times we make adjustments. We sort of have something that we're imagining, and it doesn't quite pan out exactly the way we were looking for, and it might be just a little bit of different spicing in a sauce, but sometimes it means we switch wines entirely. We think, oh, this one's going to fit, but the acidity level doesn't work with that dish, and we just have to start over. It's a really fun working relationship, and we both are really excited about trying to show off as much of what's local as possible.
Those local collaborations might include partners who come to the tasting, like White River Creamery. And sometimes it means partnerships in the kitchen. 28 Springs and another Asylum Springs-based enterprise, Pure Joy Ice Cream, have worked out a deal that allows the restaurant access to the ice cream machine and the Pure Joy folks access to the 28 Springs kitchen. And then sometimes the inspiration for a tasting might come in one of the tiny brown bottles set up neatly on one side of the bar. Little bottles of bitters.
Bitters are this great old-fashioned way of tying together the flavors in a cocktail. When we're experimenting on new drinks, there's lots of times where we'll get what we feel like is about 80% of the way there. We're like, oh, this is coming along. This is good. And it's a dash of the right bitters that will tile the flavors together, and suddenly it sings. But there's just all kinds of different, like, subtle variations between them. And we use those to just kind of nudge the cocktail just that last little sort of 20% where it needs to be to finish.
And from that finished cocktail might spring next month's tasting appetizer or entree, according to Dorothy Hall, the head chef.
And so a lot of times it is more drinks focused, and so he'll talk about the drinks and the flavor profiles, and then we kind of come up with an overall theme of what kind of foods we might like to serve. And then it's just going back and forth. Well, what if we try this? What if we try this? Until it just feels right. And so we really enjoy doing the themes, but at the same time, we always try to use local ingredients when possible, but also choose foods that reflect our region themselves while still exploring other regions. So bacon always shows up. We try to do other things that feel like authentic Southern cooking, even if we're exploring other cultures.
28 Springs is located at 100 University in downtown Siloam Springs and online at 28springs.com. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Kyle Kellums.
The Ozarks have long been home to crafters, musicians, and artists of all types. Comic strips and books are also to be included among the mixture of paintings and whittled artistic output of the region. In a turn of art imitating life, much of the published work of Gustav Carlson, a Fayetteville-based comic book artist, is set in the Ozarks, notably his Backwood Folk and Eve of the Ozarks series. He has just self-published a full-color, 84-page collection of Eve of the Ozarks in print, and when he recently spoke to Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis, Carlson said the book contains more of a collection of different stories rather than a continuing serial storyline.
Each individual issue was released digitally as a pay-as-you-want model comic online as PDFs, and each issue was pretty standalone. But once I got to the area of about 84 or 80-something pages, I thought about collecting them because, you know, it's always nice to have a print book you can flip through, and that's kind of where it ended up. But I still see it much more as collection than a continuing large graphic novel.
So how is the process for creating comics for print different than creating them for web publishing?
Well, you don't have to worry about so much the punchline at the end of every page or the story beat at the end of every single page, which is the main issue with digital comics. And as I learned, especially an issue when you're not doing a kind of joke strip or a comic strip or a comic book. But with Eve, I kind of learned to do both at the same time. I had a strip that appeared on the website weekly that was, you know, kind of your token kind of newspaper comic strip, while at the same time I would compile issues that were a longer-based story so that I tried to, you know, angle myself into the best of both worlds.
You've also used Eve as a vehicle for other physical media, right?
Yes, such as tin signs and posters and things like that.
I mean, do you see that as a useful promotional tool?
Honestly, with the tin signs, I just thought it was really neat. But no, I kind of like to explore different avenues. I've been toying with the idea of trying to do a different formats. Like each issue of Eve or each chapter of the print edition, I always would subscribe myself a certain challenge. And I think of that in a project kind of manifesto with it, that everything I do with it, something has to be kind of a challenge with it. There's an entire issue, for instance, that uses sheet music as its layout basis, since one of the characters is playing a fiddle throughout the entire issue. And I want to keep on pushing that, as seeing where I can take that kind of merging that line of comics and other art forms, be it a singular image or be it a newspaper strip or even kind of with the digital version, maybe flirt with parts of animation as well with it.
So is it difficult to find someone to produce physical copies of comics or 10 signs or what have you?
About 10 years ago, it would have been much more difficult. But thankfully, with the internet, you can be a part of the comic book world almost immediately now, whether you do just put it online digitally. But even still, if you wanted to find printers, they are out there that exist solely for production of comic books now as well.
So is that a difficult process to take your digital product and convert it into a print product? I mean, what's that process like working with the printer?
Playing a lot with the various color profiles is kind of a nightmare. Computer screens work on a color profile of RGB, and print works in a color profile of CMYK, and CMYK is a lot more muted than color profiles for computers such as RGB. And so you're always constantly battling to keep that vibrance of image from the computer screen onto the printed page. And it can result in a lot of sleepless nights right before you are sent proof of your work when it's finished.
Did you run into any issues of any of the characters in Eve maybe coming out like Smurfs whenever you were going through that process of selecting color profiles?
Luckily not, just because I've run into that issue the hard way in the past. So not necessarily on this one. But I was two of the final stories take place at night, which is the most treacherous kind of thing to color profile to a certain extent, because if it's too desaturated and if you have a mostly monochromatic color scheme, everything is just going to look the same and merge into each other, and the contrast and the composition of the image is just going to be murdered, essentially.
The characters in Backwood Folk seem more like straightforward, realistic characters, but in Eve of the Ozarks, they seem to tend more towards the realm of fantasy. How did you develop that dichotomy?
Well, it's really funny. With Backwood and Eve, they actually were developed a little bit amongst the same time. And I really, with Backwood, it was very much where I was as a person at the time. And Eve is very much more about the child that most people are kind of nostalgic about being about, where everything's much more mythic as a child. Your adventures take on a completely different tone. It's like if you ever visit one of your old childhood haunts as a kid, and then you visit it again as an adult, and how much smaller it seems. I wanted to capture that sensation of how big it used to be, you know? And Backwood's kind of almost about how small it used to be, essentially, in actuality, anyways.
Whenever you're developing your characters, do you really have them fleshed out in your mind before you start drawing, or do they tend to evolve as you're working?
Most certainly evolve. As much as you may plan a character out, you might know their favorite album of their favorite band, but you don't totally know how they're going to act in your head once you've gotten from that starting point. And that's only an evolutionary process, I think.
What about the physical characteristics of the characters? I mean, do they change as you're drawing them?
Actually, yeah, they do. With Eve, it actually turned out to be more of a wardrobe situation than with a lot of the other characters, such as those in Backwood, where initially she was kind of almost playing dress-up with the various objects in the Ozarks, whether they be, you know, feathers or leaves that she'd just kind of jam in her hair. But as I drew her, I noticed her becoming less and less kind of dressed up as a girl's idea of a princess. She became more and more of a girl's idea of a warrior almost, and it was really interesting to see her just become kind of this more like feisty kind of go-getting, fighting, rough and tough character.
Eve does seem to have somewhat of an overactive imagination, and I mean that seems to be a characteristic seen a lot in comics like Calvin of Calvin and Hobbes. Is that deliberate?
I would say it's mostly a happy coincidence. I like to believe that Eve experiences everything. It's all totally real. It's totally real and it's totally false at the same time, because within stories, the lovely part is it's both the same.
What are some of the inspirations for these characters?
A lot do come from Ozark folklore. For instance, there's a subterranean burrowing lizard called the Gowrow that appears in the Eve book, and that's actually an Ozark creature that was referenced by one of the local folklorists of the past, Vance Randolph, who mentioned them, and I believe the book was The Lies We Tell to Strangers. various other characters kind of come from a composite of my understanding of the folklore mixed with, oh, this would be a neat direction, for instance. There's the man in the moon who kind of mixes in with a folklore creature called the Moon Eye, but also then I kind of do a play on words with moonshine and this kind of viscous liquid that they drink that makes them into a monster, which you can take that as metaphoric as you like. but yeah, the inspirations, I mean, a lot of them are local, but a lot of them are other comics that I read as well. Calvin and Hobbes certainly is a big inspiration. I think that's impossible to deny, even in some of the drawing styles of it, I suppose. But, you know, a little girl running around in a folkloric place with her friend, a giant immortal goat. I mean, there's definitely comparisons to be made.
And where does the goat come from?
The goat comes from a mysterious place. No, actually, I mean, I was raised on a goat farm, so I guess that's probably the tie to my own childhood. It was, you know, me being very small and the goat seeming very large and running around in the woods with, you know, a goat on a goat farm. So they were always kind of a consistent part of my childhood.
Gustav Carlson is a Fayetteville-based comic book artist, and he recently spoke to Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis. Carlson's new collection of Eve of the Ozarks Adventures is now available in print. More information is available at eveoftheozarks.com.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, we'll look at the pros and cons of volunteer tourism.
Volunteers are being allowed to take these kids out of the orphanage and take them for trips. And unfortunately, it can attract some really unsavory people.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now, coming up next here on KUAF 91.3 FM. Ozarks at Large is sponsored in part by the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle, whose mission is to transform and expand women's giving to university programs and research through a collective voice.
And a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Springdale, and Alex, which is spelled A-L-I-X.
Where's that at?
It is just east of Denning, so it's okay. in kind of near Clarksville.
Excellent. Yeah. I don't think I'm familiar with that one. I'm always glad to learn a new place. Mm-hmm. So, well, I haven't talked to you in a little bit. How was your Thanksgiving?
It was good. It was good. You know, two Thanksgivings, two different families. So, sure. You know, I mean, nobody can complain about plenty of food and plenty of people to be thankful for. And then I went to Dallas for the weekend, just sort of a getaway. Yeah, always nice to get out of town also.
And so. Happy belated birthday.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, my birthday was yesterday. Yes. So
that was a good time. So celebration.
It was. It was. It was a week long of celebration. So.
I like it.
I'm looking forward to maybe a quiet rest of the week. Unfortunately, I don't think that's going to happen. We have, you know, Christmas show tonight.
We do have the Christmas show tonight. Thank you for bringing that up. Tonight at the Fayetteville Public Library, you, me, and Kyle will be at the Fayetteville Public Library mm-hmm. at 6:30.
Yes.
And we will be hosting a Christmas-themed edition of Ozarks at Large. We will have interviews. Becca will stop by as normal, maybe a special guest, talk to a nonprofit or two mm-hmm. about, you know, giving year-round. And we'll also have musical performances by Farmer in the Markets, the Adams Collins Band, and Jones and Leah, and they'll all be playing some of their favorite holiday selections. It's free and open to the public. We'll have some coffee and some hot chocolate, some candy canes. Mm-hmm. So I think it'll be a fun, festive time, and we hope to see some of you there.
Right.
If you can't make it, we are recording some of this so that it can be broadcast on the December 24th Christmas Eve edition of Ozarks at Large.
Mm-hmm. So that's tonight at 6:30 at the Fayetteville Public Library. That's just before the impending weather comes in tomorrow.
So lots of things happening this week.
I know, right. Forecast is calling for ice, and the last forecast I heard said a tenth of an inch by 1 p.m. tomorrow afternoon.
Okay.
So.
Well, we'll stay posted. And
yeah.
Hopefully we'll see you tonight before the weather gets too bad tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Have a little bit of celebration before maybe you hole up for the weekend.
Right.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Thanks again for listening, and have a pleasant Wednesday.